Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the seventh night, and this is the second stream, and this is with Red Pill Germany. Red Pill Germany is a YouTube channel and also a Telegram channel, both of which are linked in the description below. And, RPG, why would you like to describe the channel just so that people know what it is and what they can find there?
Yes, thank you for having me here this year, first and foremost. It's a pleasure to be here. I started my channel in 2016. And in the beginning, it was more, I would say, Manosphere content back then. There was a lot of talk going on the internet about the relationships between the sexes and so on. And I've always been... Back then and before, or for 20 years before, I think I was a conservative, or I think, yeah, more traditionalist, conservative leaning. But in the meantime, then I noticed that along the way somewhere that this whole conservatism stuff, and that had a lot of to do with the institution of marriage and feminism and all that stuff, that conservatism really is a losing strategy. It doesn't really work. And I wouldn't really call myself a conservative anymore, of course, these days. Then I developed my channel a bit and drifted more and more into politics, I would say, current issues a little bit. And now I think what describes my channel best is that I try to show to people who don't speak German, who don't live in Europe, maybe even, what is going on here. Because I noticed that the news that you see, well, I lived in the United States. I studied there for a while also. And I noticed that the news that they're getting there about Germany is rather limited. And it shows a very skewed image of Germany and sometimes Europe as a whole. And it's not that there is a lack of interest about Europe or Germany in particular there. What they get to see and hear is sometimes very weird and twisted, depending on what side of the political spectrum shows these stories or tells these stories. And I thought,
well,
yeah.
Also often the only stuff they get in English is from the mainstream media, and things that are in are more truthful might only be in German.
Yeah. So it's even worse than mainstream media. In many cases, it's only state media. And when I say state media, I literally mean that, because we both have a gigantic public broadcasting sector in Germany. But then we have actual state media. And the difference is, I mean, the way that it was explained to me is that state media would be tax funded and public broadcasting would be funded like the BBC with this household subscription radio tax fee thing, right? Which is, of course, in my opinion, just a tax that has been given a different name. It is a tax, basically. But Deutsche Welle is actually funded by tax money. And that is actual German state media. And Deutsche Welle has a huge English portfolio, or they have a lot of articles and videos in the English language. And a lot of the things that people from outside of the Reich or outside of Germany get to hear is Deutsche Welle, which is German state media. And that is sometimes problematic, I would say.
Would you say it's very biased?
It can be a little biased at times, yeah. And also, I mean, maybe everybody knows that. Everybody has at least one field of expertise or of intimate knowledge about a topic or an area. And there is this common phenomenon that when you see a mainstream media article about the thing that you know very well about, you often start noticing that it's complete crap. And because of the internet these days, you can talk to other people who have different fields of expertise or who know different things, and they observe the same thing, that what they know best about is presented in the mainstream media completely faulty on a factual level, sometimes full of mistakes and errors, and sometimes just very biased. And when all of us make that same observation in various fields, well, what does that say about the mainstream media then? And this is the cool thing about the internet and alternative media and independent content creators that have a hard time, especially this year, I guess. But on the other hand, there is also a boom, especially in Germany right now. I think particularly in Germany, there is a boom where I see various people that I first thought were complete normies. And it's like one example just from last week. It was a former colleague of mine. I always thought he's the biggest normie. And he writes me an email with a link to his Telegram channel. And I think, oh, okay, that's interesting. That's cool. Because current events just caused many Germans to distrust the public broadcasting and the mainstream. And it has not too much to do with politics. It's, of course, COVID-19. And it has something to do with politics, too. But it's more, well, it's a different topic than immigration, for example. And there is a real Querfront, so a weird coalition across the political spectrum. Yeah, the new alliances come up here, and they all distrust the mainstream quite heavily. And I think last year nobody in Germany knew about Telegram, and now some old acquaintances of mine tell me, hey, this is our Telegram channel, you should check it out. It's really funny.
Yeah, our Telegram is wonderful. I really enjoy it. It's something I try to persuade everyone to get onto. There are several things that I think, I mean, we're obviously having to adapt in that regard. And you cannot just rely on having a YouTube channel and a Twitter anymore. Because, you know, I've been banned from Twitter. I think loads of people have. And loads of people have been banned from YouTube. Not me yet, but I expect it to happen soon. So yeah, it's Telegram is a as far as we know so far, it is a stable, reliable way to keep in touch with to keep up to date with a content creator. So I would definitely advise that people do that. And I've linked yours below. So
yeah, cool. So the first thing I did was 2 years ago, I think, getting a BitChute channel, and I've never been on Facebook. I've never been on Twitter because I think that would be pointless. But now I'm on Odyssey also. And yeah, I try to diversify a little bit that I'm on many different platforms. And I guess that's good.
Well, here's a question for you about before we just get into talking about Germany in general. You said that many people don't trust the German the mainstream media, especially the state media. Would you say that the German mainstream media is more liberal than the German government, like the German state? Or do you think it's about the same? Because it's difficult to, like, the BBC in Britain, it would be difficult to say, you know, the BBC is left-wing, but in another way, it's very just status quo. It's just whatever the government is doing. So what would you say about that?
Yeah, so when you say liberal, you don't mean the Sargon of Akkad kind of liberal. You mean progressive, postmodern liberal, right? Yeah, so there are parts of the mainstream media, of the public broadcasting in Germany, that is on the surface level, on very surface level issues, they are more status quo. And some people would even call them conservative. For example, there was a higher up there who now said that this gender star notation, you must know in German there is different words for the grammatical genders, and we have a little asterisk, and then you can write both, like for male and female. It's basically rewriting or introducing new grammar rules, and he rejected that, and that is a big deal. This is like saying there shouldn't be a transgender bathroom or something like that. It goes into that direction, right? And he said that, right? And to some people, that is already so conservative, right? So they are also part of the public broadcasting, but he's very old already, and this is just maybe a generational thing. The younger down you go, there was this survey that I showed several times on my channel already. There are these young contributors to the public broadcasting, right? They might not have a permanent staff position yet, but they're like contributors,
and one day they'll be in charge.
Yeah, exactly. They're the next generation, kind of. And I think it was around 90% are aligned with the Green Party and our Communist Party, the former a socialist unity party of Eastern Germany, which they renamed themselves a couple of times, but they're still the same party, basically. And it's called Die Linke. And if you add it up.
I've heard of Die Linke.
Yeah, the left, which is it's an honest name, I would say. Yeah, it's not the whole left, but it's definitely left. Yeah. So, and if you add up the two bars for these two parties, you have around 90%, right? And there was very little else in terms of political alignment of these contributors, of these volontäre, we call it. And that just goes to show how far on the left they are. And in the print media generally, I would say that this is the corporate mainstream now, but the Green Party is probably the biggest party that these media people are aligned with. And then the Social Democrat Party, they actually own a bunch of newspapers. They have their own media empire, which not many people actually know. There are many people that think, oh, that's just a local newspaper. No, it's owned by the Social Democratic Party of Germany. So, yeah. And there are people that are very out there, very postmodernist, progressive left. And then there are people that are more status quo, social democrat types. But there are almost, I mean, like, as soon as you're a little bit right-winged or even what was still called centrist in the 90s, I guess, you're basically kicked out more or less. And then they have their own newspapers now, or they have blogs, for example. Some of them were kicked out and they just have blogs or channels now, basically like us now.
You said that the Green Party is where most of the what was it you said about the Green Party?
Now, I think in terms of the classical big broadsheet newspapers like Die Zeit or something like that, or also in the public broadcasting in the radio and in the TV. So I think the Green Party has the biggest the largest number of followers among journalists.
That's right,
They don't have too many votes. I mean, they overtook the Social Democrats, but the Social Democrats are dying. So, I mean, not physically maybe, but as a, I mean, their percentage in the elections, it is around, I don't know, I haven't checked in a long time, but around 10%, I would say. They used to have 40 some decades ago, so right. They went steep down. And the Green Party is the bigger party by now, but even more so, even more than proportional to that, in among those media types, the Green Party has the biggest following, I think.
And then there's the Die Linke, which is a different party. And what kind of percentage does it have in the parliament?
Ooh, now you're asking. It's below 10%, I would say. Right. I don't know these numbers by heart, but they have more votes in former Eastern Germany, in our Eastern states. But also in the left, they have followers, of course.
Right. I wasn't expecting to ask you those kinds of questions because, of course, people don't have these numbers stored in their heads. The reason I was just wondering. The Green Party in Britain is absolutely—it's very left wing. It's very
yeah. In Germany too,
and they're the vegans, the hippies, the completely open borders, multiculturalism, all the way feminism, all the way. They're like student leftists, but they're in their 40s and 50s and 60s. That's the Green Party in Britain. Is that what it's like, the Green Party in Germany?
I would say so, yeah, sure. I mean, I think green parties are very similar all across Europe, I would say. I mean, didn't they say last year that there is this green wave sweeping over Europe, and in all the countries the green parties are doing so left? Because people are pretty much fed up with social democrats, because not only in Germany, the classical electorate or the voters of the social democrats were sold out by Labour, for example, in the UK, and also by the SPD in Gerhard Schröder in Germany. So they made all these liberal reforms, and they cut down the welfare state and all that stuff. And so the working class feels betrayed by them, and they vote for Die Linke, or the AfD now, actually, the Patriotic Party. The Green Party is more the party that is supported by public servants and like teachers, people in the bureaucracy, people in the cathedral, as reactionaries would say. So those people who don't operate on the free market, you know, the paycheck, or it's not even called paycheck, I guess. They're hired for life. You know, they have tenure, so to speak. They can't go wrong. They have guaranteed income and pensions until they die. And those are the people who predominantly vote green, I think.
Right. Would you say that the center? Oh, I think you have said this. I just to clarify. Would you say that the center ground in politics is disappearing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So well, right now, I mean, COVID actually distorts that image that we had, or that trend we had in the last years, because Angela Merkel, believe it or not, she and her CDU party, they became really, really popular right now in this time of, yeah, let's call it a crisis, because, well, it is a crisis. I mean, not everybody thinks it's the same kind of crisis, obviously, but it is definitely a crisis that we're having this year. And the CDU, they are the rock that people can rely on, and then they are
that's the CDU is yeah. Angela Merkel's party. Christian Democratic
Union. But so before that, there was the trend that the center was melting and the fringes were gaining, and now, because of COVID, that was turned around a bit in favor of Angela Merkel's party. And now they are trying to decide who will be the next leader of the party, who will be the next chancellor candidate, because Merkel, even though everybody says, she will probably do it one more time, because next year we have an election in Germany in fall. But no, I don't think she will actually.
Was the last one with 2016?
Yeah.
With her. I couldn't believe that she won that, because that was right after the migrant crisis in September 2015.
No, wait, it was 17. So, but doesn't matter. The last election.
Right. So, and she'd just done this thing. She'd let in, was it 2 million refugees?
It depends on how you count it, but order of magnitude. Yeah, sure.
It was massive. It was an absolutely huge number of refugees. And she was just selling Germany out. I mean, I don't want to say anything too strong here, but she was clearly doing something very reckless and damaging to Germany as an economy, as a culture, as a nation, and yet she won. She got reelected. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, I think we can say that many Germans also must have thought or think that this was not in the best interest of our people, or even of our economy. Even if you're not involved with you know, more nationalist ideas, even if you just see Germany as a territory where people do business and generate wealth and want to live well somehow in peace, even then it wasn't in our best interest, I think, what she did. And still, yeah, it's amazing how many Germans, especially the older ones, they are far away from the problems that occur in certain areas in Germany, and they just don't want to think about these things. They don't want to think about our children and our grandchildren and how they will live in 30 years or something. They only see the here and now, and I think it's a little bit of boomer selfishness, maybe. I don't know. There are so many reasons and angles, but yeah.
I think they don't want to think about these things because the problems are distant from them, but also the idea that they should care about their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, that is also very distant from them, from that generation, from the boomers. They just don't think in those terms, because they were trained, they were brought up to not think in those terms of, you know, a people, your country, your nation. That is just not something that they were raised with. They were raised to think in universalist terms. But also they were raised not to think to have objections to multiculturalism. You know, they were raised to think that everyone's the same. So it's in two different ways. It's very difficult for that generation, the baby boomers, to realize what's going on now, Whereas I think for younger people, it's just self-evident. It's just there. The reality is right in front. They grow up with it in the classrooms and in the universities and so on.
Yeah, I guess so. But this year, the focus is, despite everything that happened and that still continues to happen, this year, the focus is clearly on COVID-19 and these measures that were taken, all the restrictions we had. And it is interesting to me to see how terrified the establishment is of these new alliances that I brought up. I don't know if that's the same way in other countries. We had the Yellow Vests in France, for example. That was before COVID, but that was a similar thing. I mean, that was not left or right. It was more like a working class thing, or people in the countryside revolting against these urban elites or something. And what we see now is kind of funny. I mean, I wanted to make a video, and I think I will still do it, but what the heck? I mean, there are these surveys that are being done among these people that are very critical of these government restrictions and who don't want lockdowns, and some of, I mean, there is a huge spectrum, right? It's such a diverse a crew that they have at these demonstrations and protests. There are these far left hippie type of people, these peace movement guys. There are very esoteric truthers that even deny that viruses exist, and not just this virus, any virus. They say viruses don't exist or something like that, right? Just seriously, like, yeah. Like they say stuff like, oh, have you ever seen an actual photograph of a virus and stuff like that? And then I say, well, there are transmission electron microscopes, and with these you can of course resolve nanoscopic structures and viruses. I mean, there are electron micrographs being taken of viruses on a daily basis in research labs. This is not something that's a point of discussion among scientists. This is ridiculous, right? And they said, oh, these are all computer graphics. I don't believe it. And yeah, well, so very crazy people. I mean, those are actual science deniers. I mean, this word is abused and misused a lot, but there are people where it really fits, okay? And it goes from these wacky people over just, you know, liberals, I would say, or people who like my constitution, and they say, oh, you know, our constitution says here and there and that, and liberty and civil rights and all that stuff, which is true, of course, definitely, but they are really from the center, and they're not extremely left or extremely right, but they're just really concerned about the surveillance state and the how easy it was and how fast these restrictions came, and that there are no real questions being asked and nobody makes a fuss, and they can just close down businesses and close the borders, and just because, you know. And this now is framed and is attacked by the mainstream many times as right-winged.
Yes, it's a straw man that they need. It's good. It's useful to the mainstream to have this extreme science-denying conspiracy. It's a tinfoil hat wearer that they can then mock and say those are the people who don't believe in lockdowns.
But the funny thing is, these extreme groups, and even there are extreme right wingers among them, no doubt. Yeah. But the funny thing is, those extreme groups are somewhere in there, but the mainstream just puts focus on these fringe groups in there. And they're really scared that those, I would say, I don't know, 70, I don't want to make up numbers, but I think the critical mass of the largest group are not really crazy or on the political extreme sides. And I think the mainstream is really afraid that they might, you know, hang out with those extremists, let's call them, and figure out that they're not bad people, or they're not violent or dangerous or whatever the media is saying about them. And they're just reasonable people that you can have a discussion with, and that you have sometimes even common goals and aligning agendas or goals with, and you can politically fight for what you want together with those people on certain issues, right? And this is what they're so afraid of, that
this is a trick that the mainstream use and the left have used again and again. Say that basically everyone who disagrees with you, with what you want to do, is a weirdo. It's a nutter. It's a misfit. It's some angry person living in their parents' basement who is maladjusted, who doesn't have any friends, doesn't have a sex life, you know, that it's just an incel. It's a complete weirdo. You'd never want anything to do with them. They attach their ideas that they don't like to that kind of person. So then those ideas are then associated with that kind of person. And then no one will want to believe in those ideas. It's a very social thing. It's like they don't attack the ideas. They make it a personal thing. They make it a social thing.
Yeah, so there was one really wonderful scene, I thought, from the summer. There was... in the beginning, the public broadcasting, they were still daring to go in there with camera teams when there were these protests in summer. And I think in Stuttgart, in the southwest capital of Baden-Württemberg, this is where a big group or the dominant group of this protest came up. And then they know some people from years earlier, right? So these camera guys and these photographers of the public media, I think they have their little black list of evil right-wing wingers already. And then there were these hippie guys and or the organizers, and they were putting a microphone in their faces and said, do you know that just next to you there is actually a right winger? How does that make you feel? What do you feel? Shouldn't you like distance yourself or disavow or shouldn't you call off the whole thing because you are under or infiltrated already? And then this guy just looks at him and shrugs his shoulders and says, well, I don't know. I mean, freedom of speech, right? I mean, everybody is entitled to their opinion. I mean, what? And then the interviewer from the public broadcasting was so shocked he didn't know what to say. I mean,
As soon as their tricks don't work, they don't know what to do.
Yeah,
and that's something you see time and again. This is why they don't interview people from dissident politics, because they cannot handle them.
Yeah, or they just know that the person that they're interviewing is going to be a lolcow or some kind of nut job, and they just, you know, try to present him as.
It's becoming a very tedious and predictable thing. You know, the way the mainstream media works, the way that it attacks or doesn't even attack ideas, just dismisses ideas. I mean, on the BBC. You just don't get this debate about COVID. It's just not there. And well, do we actually need to be doing these lockdowns? Do we need to be doing social distancing? Do we need to be wearing the masks? It's sort of mentioned in passing, but not taken seriously at all. And this has been the case with everything. Same with mass immigration, same with, you know, LGBT. It's just assumed. And I guess that probably has been the case since... the gay marriage thing was in 2012 in Britain, I think.
Okay.
I think it was 2012, 2013. And really, at that point, it was just, this is the consensus. There is no need to go into other arguments, to explore other sides of this debate, because they're just not legitimate. They're simply not legitimate. There is only one legitimate point of view that you can have on this matter. And anyone who doesn't have that point of view is a bad person. That anyone who's not from mass immigration is obviously a bad... Of course, we all know they're a bad person. So why would we even interview them? This seems to be the attitude. And again, if you read the Guardian newspaper or the equivalent in Germany, if that's what... And all your friends read that, then you're going to be in very much a bubble. And it's going to be very natural for you to think that anyone who doesn't read that is just some crazy person.
Yeah, it's funny. Just prior to the election in the US, I talked to an older friend of mine in America, and we were also talking about, you know, alt media, mainstream media, all that stuff. And then he's like, don't think that I just get my information just from one source. I get information from various sources. I mean, I watch CNN and NBC, and I read the New York, whatever, Washington Post, and I'm like, right. And you know, I mean, I can't say anything because, I just say, that's great. That's, you did your research.
Yeah, that's tragic. You know that. Is that an older person or a younger person?
It's like in his mid-40s, I think. Yeah.
Right, okay. So it's Gen X.
But it was just funny. Like he actually thinks that he's getting information from various sources.
Yeah, there's a tragedy about that. You know, it's like he doesn't know that he's just getting poisoned. You know, whatever. There is no great variety of views there. That's a real shame because that's a guy who's been completely tricked into a sort of state of delusion and a fake notion of himself as an informed person when he's really not.
I thought for a second that he was joking, and then I realized no, he's not joking. Damn it. I thought he makes a sarcastic joke or something like that, but no, he actually meant that. Oh, yeah.
Oh dear. That is sad. But I think it's very typical, and you get, because people don't realize how homogenous the mainstream media actually is. I think that because there's this fake war that's set up between. Yeah, you know, like in Britain, the Guardian and the Daily Telegraph. But the Guardian and the Daily Telegraph are both pro-gay marriage. They're both pro-mass immigration. They're both pro-multiculturalism. So what is it that they actually disagree on? Not very much. I would struggle to think of something that they would disagree on, really, like a fundamental thing. So, but they pretend that they're on, that they hate each other. You know, these two newspapers are just, no common ground between them at all. And I'm sure it's the same in Germany. There's this fake... wasn't there actually a quote from Chomsky about this? That to narrow the range of possible thought, but then encourage a lot of frantic activity within that very narrow range. I think that there was a quote from Chomsky about that. And you see it in real time in the mainstream media.
Yeah, so if you extrapolate that into the future, then they will be arguing about... I don't know. I don't want to give an example now, but teeny tiny differences in very, very degenerate fields. You know?
Yeah.
But and I think time is a really decisive factor here. Maybe that is not talked about so much, but time is very important. So the duration or the speed at which something progresses, because sometimes these people who think of themselves that they're in different camps, they just differ from the other quote-unquote side by how fast they change. Like, let's come back to the conservatives, for example. I think there isn't, for me at least, there is no big difference between the leftists and the conservatives, or the progressives and the centrists. They're just a teeny tiny little bit slower, but their trajectory goes to the same point ultimately. It's just that they're a little bit slower, but it takes them half a year longer, but then they accept all that stuff.
Yes. Yes. This is what came up with one of my previous guests. I think last night we were saying this, that the conservative simply maintains what the left established 10 years ago.
Now it seems to me that they're just sticking to those things for just as long so that they can argue a little bit about it. And when that news cycle is over after a month or something, then they adopt it already. It's crazy how fast this has become. And I guess that caught up with me at some point. I mean, they always say, oh, they're boiling the frog slowly so he doesn't notice that the water is getting warmer. I don't think it's boiling the frog slowly anymore. I really don't think that way. And it was, I mean, I started out as something as a conservative like 10 years ago, maybe. But I noticed this boiling the frog slowly thing was a little bit too fast for me, I guess, and I just stuck there, and I just didn't move as fast as the rest, probably. But
I think that that's the thing. I think they're at the point now where they no longer care whether the frog wakes up. I think they quite openly despise the public now.
Yeah, there is a lid on the pot, so the frog can't jump out. There is a lid, so you can boil the frog as fast as you want now.
Yeah. So what would you say about the state of German society now compared to 2015? Because I moved to Germany for a year in early 2017 to... early 2018.
So and, in the middle.
In the middle. And it was in Bavaria. So the migrant crisis didn't really affect Bavaria that, or at least not Nuremberg, very much. But I know that the north and what's it called? North? Oh, I've forgotten what the term is.
Norddeutschland?
North Rhine-West.
North Rhine-Westphalia, yeah.
Yeah, yes, because people were calling it North Rhine-West Somalia.
Call it North Rhine-Westphalia.
That cost me
some subscribers already, actually. Some people really, really are affected by when they come from there or something, and they say, what are you saying about my home state?
But it did affect, I know it affected the north, like Bremen, Hamburg, Cologne, Frankfurt. They got huge numbers of refugees. But obviously, the refugees are just one element of the change in German society. What direction would you say it's going in? I mean, are you optimistic about the future of Germany?
No, not at all. So even before 2020, I said that it is pretty obvious to me that some sort of an economic cycle or a boom time since 2008 or 2009, or when the last economic crisis was, it must come to an end at some point. And I'm not an economist and I don't claim that I understand all these things, but it seems to me that with printing money and with government intervention, they try to stall for as much as they can. And now this COVID thing happened, I would say. But I already said back then that it is kind of a powder keg or maybe some kind of metastable equilibrium state in Germany, that it just takes a little bit of a hiccup, some little ignition, and then things could go really bad in very, very in a very short time. And that is, for example, if our economy would collapse, like if the German automotive industry, for example, as we see right now, actually, would take a huge hit. It doesn't take long, I think. And we always say, oh, next year something will come. But I just cannot see how next year should be a good year for the German economy. I just can't see it, because the automotive industry was already struggling in 2019. And now the factories were closed. People are probably not buying cars right now. So I just think that and I thought that would happen in autumn, but they prolonged it until next year, I think, until January. There are laws or rules for that you have to file for bankruptcy as a business or something, and they basically waived those conditions. So I think once that waiver is lifted again, we will see a lot of bankruptcies. Whenever that will be. I thought it would be autumn, but they extended it. So I think next year we will see a lot of small businesses, family-owned businesses, medium businesses, and even the large corporations, the automotive industry, they will struggle. We will see a lot of companies closing down. We will see a lot of unemployment, that is for sure. I just can't imagine how they would pull this off. There has to be an economic setback now. I can't see how they would do that. No money printing in the world will help them right now, I think. And people are not going to consume, those companies are lost now, I think. They're like zombies or something, or dead men walking. I think they're still there on paper, but they're already lost, I think. And then we will have a problem.
It's so depressing, and it's a similar situation in Britain. But I think that in Britain, there's more of a, and this might be a completely inaccurate perception of mine, but I think that Britain has already lost a lot of its industry, and a lot of it is the service, like people work in the service sector far more than in industry. Whereas in Germany, I think there is still, I mean, it's easy to forget that Germany is one of the powerhouses of the world. It's one of the industrial hotspots of the world because Germans are such good engineers. That's something that's true. It's a stereotype that's true, that the Germans are extremely logical, hardworking, diligent, and precise, and so on. And there is this, and of course, there is the love of giving yourself to a profession, Arbeit, and so on. And I think it's a kind of strange thing that we're going to see in the future, where there are going to be lots of Germans who just can't do that anymore. It's just not a profession or a way of living that's available to them anymore.
And that scares me, actually. I mean, I was looking at the, when was that? A couple of years ago, I watched a documentary and I did some research on the car industry in the UK. And maybe some younger people don't know that, but it was ridiculously strong. It was really strong. And then there was a combination of government intervention, and they merged, and they wanted to become stronger together. And there was some competition from Germany and Japan, of course, at that time. I think it was the 70s or then ultimately in the 80s, and it never recovered. And there was also this trend from the politicians, I guess, to go into the service industries, that manufacturing is something like the old industries like coal and steel. That's not modern anymore, and it's not hip and trendy. And that's the good thing about Germany. We never did that. There was never a time when most Germans thought that we don't need a manufacturing sector anymore. And this kept us healthy so far, economically speaking. But I think even though we want to have a manufacturing sector, or most of us want to, the politicians are, they're killing it. They're killing it with so many things. I mean, we stopped nuclear power. Now they want to discontinue coal power. Our energy prices are one of the highest in the world. And now these lockdowns and the crisis in the automotive industry, I just think there will be a lot of layoffs, and I'm really scared, actually, that something that happened in the 70s and 80s in the UK will now happen, something similar in Germany, and that would be very unfortunate. And there are many accelerationists, sorry that I add that. I mean, there are many people that are waiting for that, and they're cheering for that, actually. Yeah, I want to see unemployment. I want to see suffering. But I actually don't want that, actually. I don't want that for my people. I have to be clear on that. I really don't want that, but yeah.
No, because it's so important. I mean, it's such an important thing for individuals to have a sense of fulfillment, but also for the country to feel we still produce things. I mean, this is a big cliche with America and Britain, that we don't have these expressions that made in Britain, made in America. It's now made in China, made in Taiwan, made in Korea, etc. And it's depressing, because that just creates this sense that, well, we don't really make anything anymore. We cannot be, and we couldn't be, independent of globalism. If the whole global order collapsed, we'd be completely screwed, because we are not self-sufficient. We're not a people who can live, who can secure the conditions around them anymore. That's a terribly sort of depressing and demoralizing thing to believe about yourselves.
Absolutely. But I would say that Germans are, maybe we could, but there would be a transition if we had to be independent of globalism or the global economy or something like that. I mean, we still make stuff and we would have to readapt or something. But right now, we are part of the globalist system, definitely. Our larger corporations definitely are. And then there are these family companies, these family-owned companies, mid-sized companies. They have these niche products that the big corporations need. Like they have some product that they perfected over the years, and only they make that. And as they say, the thing that goes into the thing that goes into the thing. Like, it's industry to industry. Like the end consumer doesn't even know that these things exist. These tools or these materials or these processes. They don't even know that this stuff exists. They only know what they see in the supermarket or on Amazon or in maybe cars in a car dealership or something. But these other companies, most German companies, probably make stuff that's not even for the end consumer. So and they are needed by the globalist economy, but they could also make other things, of course.
Oh yes. Do you think that it would be better for everyone if the global order, globalism, if it just failed and we had to rely on producing and maintaining everything in our own countries again? Or do you think that would be a bad way to live, to revert to that?
I mean, if you take it to the extreme, I would think it would be a bad thing, because the basic idea of free or at least global trade or international trade is a good one, I think. Certain countries have things that other countries don't have, or they're better at other. I mean, this is always how in the economy class in school or something, this idea is introduced. It's a very, very innocent sounding, very vague and general thing. Oh, some countries are better at this, but the other country is better at the other thing. And if they specialize in trade, then they both have an increase in wealth. And that idea is not wrong. It's just very, very general, maybe oversimplifying things. So if you go to the extreme that borders would be closed and every country must be self-sufficient, I think it would be bad. But the way it is right now, that avocados are coming from Central America somewhere so that German vegans can think that they eat sustainably. We all know these crazy examples of stuff that is shipped around the globe, even though like 10 kilometers away you would have a source that would be like 2 cents more expensive, but that's right there, right? I mean, these crazy stories, we all know them, and it's real. And in a certain way, I think 2020 was already a little bit of a shock to this globalist system. I don't think it will go away, but many supply chains were disrupted because of the lockdowns and because of factories that were closed down somewhere on the other side of the planet. And then people started noticing, hey, wait a second. So we are dependent on factories in China for, you know, as because they make something that people need that sell us another thing or something. Like, these supply chains are sometimes ridiculously long and intertwined, and people didn't even know before that they're actually dependent on something in this or that or the other country that was under lockdown or that was closed, or the planes just didn't fly anymore. That was crazy. And especially making medicine, for example. I think the US noticed then, oh, we can't produce our own medicine. Or I think even in Europe, we noticed that, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In Britain, we're dependent on China, the pharmaceutical industry in China. Yeah. I don't know why. It's crazy. It's obviously insane. But we're dependent on China to make medicines for us that we buy from them. It's just obviously a bad idea. But I think you're absolutely right that one of the things that really struck me at the start of the lockdown in March, April was, oh, my God, life isn't normal anymore. It's not just that we're in lockdown, but that things aren't available that were available a month ago. It's like that sort of post-apocalyptic thing that you see in science fiction films where, oh my God, things have changed. The normal life has gone away. And that, I mean, we had a very gentle version of that in April. It wasn't disaster. It wasn't zombies. It wasn't a plague. But still, normal life went away. It stopped. And things that you could do, you couldn't do anymore. Things that were possible were no longer possible. And that was rather, it was scary, because I thought, okay, this is what it's going to be like if the shit ever does really hit the fan. This is how it's going to start. It's going to start with things, you're going to see this, that systems no longer work. Things are breaking down. And so, you know, for example, I'll give you a very trivial example. And now and then, you know, I've got a reputation for living an unhealthy lifestyle and having a fondness for pizzas. I sometimes talk about pizzas. And there are some people who seem to think that I eat multiple pizzas a day. I don't. But about once a week, once every 2 weeks, I'll order a Domino's pizza, especially during Millennial. Although I haven't done it yet, actually. But anyway, Domino's pizza. The website, half of the ingredients were, like, you could say, basically their menu was suddenly restricted. And they can't, the things like extra ingredients that you could add, that wasn't possible anymore. And that was the first thing that I saw, and I thought, oh, wow. This is the start of things falling apart. It's something as trivial as that, something as it doesn't matter, it's not important, but it's a luxury that we have been accustomed to. You know, being able, and it is really a lot, I mean, it's an incredible luxury to be able to just order some food online and then it shows up at your house 15 minutes later. You know, it's been a very long journey from, you know, caveman times where you had to hunt your own food. But we've now got this far where you can just push some buttons on the screen and then the food arrives. It's amazing. But suddenly that luxury was impeded. It was reduced because of the lockdown. Now, I'm not really saying anything profound here. I'm just noting that it was interesting that that felt like the start of, okay, this is what it'll be like when globalism starts to fail. Things that were available will no longer be available.
Yeah, and many people said that, this is now a warning for this or the other. Like I said, like with our supply chains, or that we need foreign sources to make medicine or something. But for me, it was also something else. It was a warning or a showcasing of how unprepared people are for just the slightest inconvenience in their life. And I'm not trying to minimize or downplay it, but compared to a war breaking out or an actual disaster, like some kind of an earthquake or something like that, this is very mild and people freaked out. And I think people should freak out about all these restrictions and the surveillance and all that stuff. Yeah, but I mean, in the very beginning in March, you know, when nobody really knew how bad it is and people were more or less more on the cautious side and they were agreeing with these things. Even I was, I have to say. Just these inconveniences, as you said, and people completely freak out. So I wonder, like, these people, how will they react when something substantial will happen? And maybe that was a warning for them. And we could observe this for so many years already, like all these zombie movies, all these post-apocalyptic science fiction fantasy things. I mean, I don't know how it was 100 years ago or something, but have people always been so fascinated to that degree with these what if civilization fails kind of scenarios? Because
I don't know. I remember that there is a program called Survivors from the mid-70s.
Yeah.
Talked about quite a lot of times on my channel because I love it. That's 1975, but I know that it does go back farther than that. There has been a fascination. I think it is a post-industrial thing. It's a post-industrial society. It's this fascination with what if all of this luxury went away? And I want to emphasize, I know that the Domino's website's menu being restricted, that is not the end of the world. I just want to make sure that everyone...
You want to make that very clear to everyone.
I'm not that bad. But it just felt like, oh, wow, this is what it'll be like.
Well, what if you had to drink Pepsi? Ooh.
Well, it doesn't bear thinking about. But someone did point out that when we had to hunt our own food, that was good for that was good for us in a different way. And of course it was. I mean, this is the thing. I remember the first time, it was actually in Nuremberg, funnily enough, the first time I ordered food online. And it was this website called, you might know it, Lieferando.
Yeah, there are commercials of this company everywhere. I think they must have grown like crazy this year.
yeah, they will have. It was Lieferando, and it was incredible. I mean, they had all these, you could choose what type of food it was that you wanted to order. Then it would give you a list of takeaways in your area that were doing that kind of food. Then you would choose one of the takeaway places. It would show you their menu. Then you would order the stuff. And there were even user reviews. For each of these takeaway companies, it would like other people, other Lieferando users had reviewed each place. So you could limit it to like 5-star places, 4-star. And I remember thinking, I was astonished. I'd never done this before. And I was amazed that, my God, that we have such luxury now. We're able to do this. And I remember always feeling a bit guilty that I kept thinking, is this right? Should we be able to live like this? I mean, shouldn't I have to do something to get like, because it is, it does, it's just so easy. You know, it makes it so easy to just, you know, because there's that horrific meme which you might have seen of the guy plugged into the, like, the Pepsi machine, the McDonald's machine, and he's basically attached to this chair, and he's got a screen in front of him that shows him whatever porn all day, something like that. And that's like the man of the future. You know, the globalist man will be this just blob. And it's grotesque. It's completely grotesque. And I can't help wondering, really, maybe it would be good for us if we did lose some of this. And I mean, it would be, let's face it, it just would be good for us if we lost some of this luxury.
Undoubtedly. But the funny thing is that during this year's crisis, at least, all these things increased. They actually increased. They didn't become less. People order more food online and stuff like that. And I have, until this day, I haven't done that yet, ever. But
well done.
Who knows?
That's true. It's an irony, isn't it? That the menus became more restricted because of the supply chains. But people ordered more. People were ordering much more online because they couldn't go to restaurants or whatever. So it's like they were doing more of less. And again, that might well be what we end up. I can imagine globalists thinking that's what the plebs should have. That's what the general public should have. Just give them a bit of choice, but keep it shitty. Keep it like it's fast food. It's a very degraded existence, and I think in some ways it would be scary to lose it, but I also think it would be good for us to lose it.
Yeah, and you see that for a long time already. You see, like, how they marketed margarine to people instead of butter. It's an inferior product, clearly, but they sell it for almost the same price. And now they sell, like, peas and chickpeas and potato slur as artificial meat. And it costs even more than actual meat. But it is so great for the industry, you know. It's so awesome. This is exactly what they want. They can take a cheap product like peas, and they can put it like they freeze dry it and they grind it down and they put it through a nozzle and make it like a foam so that it gets flaky like meat, like texture wise and they put some artificial heme whatever blood like flavor in it. I don't know, but it's perfect for them because it's cheap, it's processed, and they can sell it for even more. And the profit margin must be ridiculous. And it can be made in a factory, you know, and this is their dream, right? This is their dream. And if they can send it to you online, that's even better. If you order it online and you just have like the Amazon of food, then probably, or maybe it will be Amazon. I don't know. I'm sure these scenarios are all fleshed out already and their plans are ready to go with that. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's not what Otto von Bismarck would have wanted for the
no. So you checked my channel recently, yeah?
Oh, I already knew about Otto von Bismarck.
Just today uploaded a video about him or his statue in Hamburg.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. You didn't? Oh, I thought I just like 3 hours ago uploaded a video about the gigantic Otto von Bismarck statue in Hamburg that they want to tear down or to turn into a mockery version, like beheaded and put the head at his feet or turn it around or something like that. Oh, I really thought you're talking about
no, that. I was just making a whimsical reference to German history, and it turns out that I've stumbled upon another example of the globalists destroying everything.
Yeah. No, Otto von Bismarck would not have wanted that, I'm sure.
Indeed. All right, well, let's leave it at that, because that's been a nice, fast-paced, but still very concise interview. So I like to keep it like that. So excellent. Well, thank you very much, Red Pill Germany. I think that there have been lots of good comments in the live chat, very positive. So I think people have enjoyed hearing from you. So thank you for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. I'll be back in about an hour to talk about Bitcoin more. And then after that, it'll be Jared Taylor, but only on DLive. All right. I'll see you all later. Thanks for watching.